listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very special guest, singer sensation Elliot Yaman. How are you, Elliot?
I'm doing great, Nikki. Good to see you, man.
Dude, this is like perfect lighting, perfect everything. This is great.
It's working out.
So, you know what? You made a huge presence in American Idol. And, you know, I was actually just talking to my girlfriend. I told her that you're my guest. And she was like, I voted for him. And I was like, I got to tell him that because that's awesome. So you made it to the top three. So, you know, before that, though, tell me, before you made that break, tell me how you got into music. What was the moment of zen that made you want to become a singer?
Well, we'll have to go back to like 19. First of all, people always ask me how long I've been singing for, and I always tell them since the doctor said push.
So that's awesome.
I was just born with a natural ability, and I'm pretty sure that I got it passed down from my mom, who was a soul singer, and always sang around us in the house and in the car, and just was always singing. So I'm pretty sure that I got the bug pretty early in life. And so there was a couple instances that really sort of forged my my relationship with music and the first one starts in, I'd say it probably has to be like 1986 when we were living in Pasadena as a child. Our neighbors, our next door neighbors had a recording studio in their living room, and their living room was sort of converted into a live room where they would cut. Wow. Like, we would always hear live instruments coming from next door, and I was always intrigued by that, and I was always drawn to music, obviously. So one day we were getting home and we were getting out of the car, and I think we came from the grocery store and we were helping our mom with the bags and stuff. And the neighbor came over, young guy, and he asked my mom if it would be cool if I came over and recorded with them. And the reason he did that was because I used to always sing in my bedroom with the windows open and they would always hear me. Wow. And so, you know, they sort of explained to my mom, like, we hear him all the time singing, and we would love to him to come over and check out our studio and see if he'd be interested in singing with us. And so, me not knowing anything about recording studios or gear or how any of that works, she was like, yeah, that's cool. Go right ahead. Like, that'd be awesome. And I just remember going over there one day, and I don't know why, because I was so young and so I don't really know like all the details or remember all the details as far as like how things were set up or why things were the way they were, but we recorded a version of Hound Dog by Elvis Presley. Oh, they wow. were recording a version of it. And so they asked if I'd sing, and so I cut You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog when I was like 8 years old, you know?
That's
and awesome. And I just remember the feeling that I had the first time ever hearing the playback and realizing that that was my voice coming through the speakers. And, you know, we hear ourselves differently than others hear us. Right.
Right.
So I was just like, whoa, that's me, you know?
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe that that's what I sounded like And I'm not going to say I was feeling myself because I didn't know what, I didn't know what was cool or what sounded right or wrong or good or bad. But I liked what I heard and I just wanted to do more of it.
What's cool about that too, it's like, you know, when you're a young kid, you're learning how to be confident. You're learning that sense of self. And to have that so young, that's had to be huge for your confidence just to be able to get up there and perform, you know?
It really was, man. I just remember the feeling that I had when I was singing, you know, on the mic and recording it, you know, and then of course the full circle hearing the playback. And I just thought, I just want to keep doing this the rest of my life. But I mean, even before that, first of all, shout out to my old neighbors in Pasadena. I wish I knew who they were and whatever happened to them. And who, for all I know, they could have turned out to be big stars, or they could have been like major players. I have no idea. And I don't know if I'll ever figure that out, but I've always wondered what happened to those guys, because they were super cool. They definitely instilled a lot of confidence in me that I didn't even know existed, because I was very shy at that point. And obviously I had no, you know, I had no training, I had no stage presence. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But it was so much fun. And so, but if we rewind a little further back, I remember being 5 years old and my mom was playing a Stevie Wonder record vinyl. And I don't remember which record it was, but I remember hearing it and just being blown away by the soul coming out of his voice. And my mom was very soulful. She was a short, fat little Jewish lady.
That's awesome.
Who could sing like Aretha, you know?
Right.
So I just remember, and then I remember we were watching some kind of telethon or something. It might have been like, I forget what it was, but it was some kind of like donate to this charity, like long, all day long telethon that was going on. Stevie Wonder performed on it. And I saw him perform, and I told my mom, I said, that's what I want to do.
Wow.
That's what I want to do with my life. That's what I want to do forever.
And you were what, 12? You're 11?
I was 5. I was 5.
Wow. Wow.
So, I mean, I knew early on that I knew that I had something in me that I couldn't explain, but it was something that really fueled me and gave me so much joy. And then as I got older, I realized it gave other people joy. And that's a really infectious, powerful feeling, you know, when you can make people feel something in a positive way, obviously. And so I just wanted to do that. That's what I wanted to do with my life. And I had no idea how to get there or how to figure that out. So if you want to fast forward all the way to your girlfriend's voting days,
that's right,
American Idol.
What's crazy?
I mean, that, you know.
What's crazy, I grew up in Arcadia. So like we were like in neighboring cities, and like I got into singing when I was about 5 through the church choir. But then like one of the directors started this professional children's chorus called the LA Children's Chorus. So we were doing these like crazy gigs, like singing with Luther Vandross, singing at the Grammy Awards. So had our paths crossed, man, I would have recruited you in this singing group, dude. We would have been singing together, bro.
Wow. Who knows? Yeah, who knows what the trajectory would have looked like then, you know?
But you also moved, right? You moved somewhere. I think you moved to Virginia. Was that right?
Yeah, yeah. So we when I was 10, we moved from Pasadena to Richmond, Virginia, across the country in like the middle of the beginning of the fifth grade for me. And wow. My mom had she got a really good job offer that she couldn't refuse, and she grew up in Richmond. So and my dad wasn't really working at the time, and we split for the East Coast, and I was just, even at 10 years old, I was just like, what planet am I on when we got there? It was just such a culture shock, because it was just such a different planet, you know. And but that's where I, you know, that's where I really grew up and really spent my formative years, like figuring out that I had this voice and trying to use it and, you know, honing my skills and learning and growing vocally and working all kinds of jobs. And, you know, so, but so that's where I really, you know, cut my teeth and really grew up. And yeah, I lived there for 16 years until I auditioned for American Idol.
Did you take like any chorus classes or like were you in any kind of musical theater or anything like that?
No. I'll tell you, we in middle school, we could choose an elective each year. And so I chose chorus, not because I wanted to sing in front of others, because I was really I had tremendous stage fright. But all the hot girls, not to sound like that guy, but all the hot girls took chorus. So
yeah,
I was like, I'm gonna get in with these ladies here, and that was my real motivation to get into chorus. But once I was in there, I realized that I learned a lot. I learned a lot of music, and then we had like these like a couple of these like all county not recitals but concerts that we would do with other neighboring schools. We did a couple of those. I would always stand in the back and I would like basically lip sync because I was that scared. Even in a chorus setting, I never wanted anyone to hear me. It was just weird. I don't know why. I guess I reverted back. I didn't have that kind of confidence yet, you know? But yeah, so that's really the extent of my okay, in my you know, formative, you know, younger days. And then as I got a little older, I sang around town in Richmond with a couple of different jazz bands. And I would always go to open mics and like try to work up the nerve to get up there. And I never did. I never did for like a couple of years. And then I finally got up the nerve to get up there once with an actual band, you know, live instruments. And that really, that really just made me feel something even greater, just because I've got these live instruments behind me, just making beautiful music. And I really love that feeling. And I just wanted more. Everything was just like, just give me more once I got a little taste, you know?
Right.
And then besides that though, I played a few, like I only had a few paid gigs with this band, and that was fun. And then aside from that, like I would do drunken karaoke with my friends, and then as I got a little older and them knowing how shy I was, they would actually like wait till I went to the restroom or was over at another table talking to some friends, and they would sign me up like behind my back. Oh, and they would make me go. And then I would like just hear my name being called out of nowhere unexpectedly. And the first time that happened to me, I just bolted out of the back door, jumped in my car and drove home. That's how scared I was. But then they, you know, they believed in me more than I believed in myself. And sometimes it takes more often times than not, it takes other people who's got your back and who believe in you to really instill that confidence in you. And I'm grateful that I had friends like that. I mean, that's really how I ended up on American Idol. I always say that it was a lot like that scene in Good Will Hunting, the movie Good Will Hunting, when, you know, when Ben Affleck and Casey Affleck are telling Matt Damon, they're like, listen, dude, we every morning we come here to pick you up and we go to work and we go work our construction job and then we go grab beers afterwards and then we wake up and we do it all over again. And long story short, he's like, you have a gift, dude. You're smarter than anybody we know. So every morning when we pull up to pick you up from work, we're just hoping and praying secretly that you're not coming out. You're not going to come out because you're gone. You took off and you're going to go take advantage of your gift. And so that's basically what my best friends in Richmond told me. But they also added a little little extra flair. They threatened my life if I didn't go try to do something. And these are big dudes that don't take any shit. So and they mean what they say. So they were like, we're gonna kick your ass, dude. If you do not go try, Go try to go try. Just go try. What do you got to lose? Nothing. So it took threats for me to really, like, you know, figure out and understand that I really, at that particular time, I truly had, like, I was the epitome of having nothing to lose and only everything to gain. So I took their advice, and that's how I ended up, you know, going to try out for the show. No expectations, literally a few bucks left in my account after I spent money renting a car with my girlfriend at the time. And we drove from Richmond to Boston.
Crazy.
Where the closest audition was. And that's how it all started professionally.
It's like a cattle call, you know? So like you're there with
it is.
Thousands and thousands of people. So tell me what that was like for you. Was it deflating? Was it just like, how long did you wait for your first audition? Like, tell me what that audition process was like for you.
It was all the things. It was definitely deflating. I just didn't know what to expect. And which was great, because I was just going in feet first and just ready to, you know, like tackle whatever was thrown our way, you know. So so the first audition is a cattle call. It's they're usually at big stadiums. They were back then. And it was at Gillette Stadium where the Patriots play. And of course, to add to the story, it was like monsooning outside. It was a torrential downpour the entire day.
Right.
So everyone's in line. We waited in line outside, and we bought a poncho from a guy selling ponchos in the parking lot. I mean, we're just getting dumped on with rain. And then I'd say we probably waited outside the stadium for like an hour and a half, maybe. And then we got in, and then we had to wait a subsequent extra 12 hours before our section in the stadium was called to go down to the field to get in line to audition. And there was over 10,000 people there that day. So, it was very intimidating, dude, because I had, with my limited like experience being around other musicians and other performers, very limited. I walk into this arena and I'm hearing and seeing all these different people who were there for the same thing, like practicing their songs. And one chick over here is doing her vocal runs, and then another one's doing these vocal exercises. And I'm hearing some incredible, incredible vocalists like all around me. And I had, first of all, I'd never been in that setting before, whether it be in a, you know, chorus class or a stadium. I'd just never been around other like-minded, singers, vocalists like that. So I was just really impressed. And then I thought to myself, like, what? And I think it's natural, but I think everyone feels this at some point. But like, okay, what am I doing here? Like, what are they going to see in me? I mean, these people are incredible. I mean, how am I going to stack up? So you get a little lost in the sauce there for a minute, and then you reel yourself back in and you're like, wait, we just drove 12 hours to get up here, dude. Like, there's no turning back now. I'm all in. And so I use that to inspire me. And they're like, okay, I can sing too. That's why I'm here.
Right.
You know, we're going to give it a shot and figure out if we belong here, you know. And I had plenty of time, obviously, to figure all that out, because we were there for 12 plus hours.
Wow.
They had like these tents set up on the field, and when they call your section, you go down on the field, and you know, you line up like in rows of four, and then like four across and four back. And when you audition, you literally are auditioning around other auditioners.
Wow.
who are like, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 feet from you. So you're hearing a lot of great vocals, but you're also hearing a lot of, questionable stuff too.
Yeah.
And so,
I always think about those people when they're like, yeah, I'm going to do the audition. I'm like, man, you got some serious confidence. That's like, I kind of respect it. It's like, man, you're not sure. You're going to find out real quick if you don't have it. But the fact that you are willing to swing the bat, man, that takes some serious balls, you know.
That alone, for real, man. Yeah, I mean, that alone is just so admirable, you know, just to make the decision to do that. Now, of course, there were plenty of people that were, they were all dressed in costumes and were looking to really get on TV, you know, and
right.
had no, like, maybe didn't have any musical skills, but had something. I mean, for the most part, there were a lot of, and the tricky thing was, dude, is that they sent a lot of really great singers home.
Right.
And so that was another intimidating factor. We're like, what? Oh, okay. You right. sent her home. She just blew the roof off of the stadium.
Right. Right.
And what's happening here? How? And then you're back to yourself. How am I going to make it? You know? So there's all these emotions running high and you question all kinds of stuff as you do whenever you're making a big leap with anything in life, you know? And, but at that point, you know, like I said, I was all in and there was nothing else. There was nothing to fall back on, really, you know? And so I really had nothing to lose. And
how many auditions did you have to do in the field before you got to, you know, Simon Cowell and Randy and the, you know, Paula?
Well, there was the cattle call at the stadium, and then after that, 2 days later, we were, those that made it through that round were asked to come back, not to the stadium, but to there was a hotel in the harbor downtown Boston.
And how many times did you have to sing in the stadium too?
Just once.
Okay.
Just once. And it was literally like 30, 45 seconds at the most.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, that's part of why I was like, wait a minute. You know, like I just heard some incredible voices that got sent packing and I got a little shook, you know. I'm like, all right, that's all we get. 30 seconds to make a first impression.
What did you sing first in that 30 seconds? Do you remember?
Of course. I sang Leon Russell's A Song for You.
Oh, good choice, dude.
You know, I do it with the Donnie inflections and the Donnie, you know, version. But yeah, that was a tough call too, because the whole ride up there, you know, we were making a list and checking it thrice, you know, and narrowing down our list to what songs to audition with, and that was my go-to song, and that's what I use for every audition. I was just kind of one of those, if it ain't broke, you know, right, don't fix it. So and it kept working, so that was sort of my good luck charm. And then you know, so yeah, after the stadium, you come back 2 days later and you have an audition for the producers. See, at the stadium, they're just slowly production system that are hearing right. you for the first time. And so then you go through, you're lucky to make it, and you go through the player's tunnel and they lead you to this room. And I'm telling you, man, there's a stack of paperwork that are contracts with language in it that I had never even knew existed.
Right.
Literally, man, this big. And we had to sift through it all, sign it with no lawyer, no, you just know if you don't sign, you don't get through, you know, you don't keep going. So I'm going flipping through the pages, trying to like make out the jargon and no idea what any of this means, sign away. And then, okay, come back 2 days later. So I come back 2 days later and the next audition 2 days later was for the producers of the show, some of the producers of the show. And then I made it through that round. And then they sent us home. And so we go home. And then the third audition was the first time we saw the judges.
Okay.
And that was back in Boston. And that was like 2 months later, two months later. So I went home, knew I'd made it, you know, that far, and then went back home and then, you know, went back to work and live my life. And then 2 months later, I flew up to Boston with my mom and my brother, the three of us. My brother came and then he had to leave early. Anyways, the three of us flew up there together as a family, and they were there to support. And yeah, I made it. That was the round where I made it to the Hollywood round and made it through with the judges. And Yeah. And so another thing I always wish for when I lived growing up in Richmond is I always wanted to come back to LA. I always wanted to make it someday. So in a very strange way, I ended up back here through, you know, full circle through American Idol, you know, because I made it to Hollywood and so I ended up, you know, coming back out here for the Hollywood rounds of the show, and you know, just ended up kept making it through every week, and I haven't left.
There were like 10 rounds, right? There was something like that, maybe more than that.
10 rounds for the whole season, you mean?
Yeah.
God, it was so long ago now. I have to really think about how long it was. It was
doing like, because it was season 5, like they obviously they changed the format, so like they're bringing in a lot of guests, you know, big artists. Were they doing that by season 5 as well?
Oh yeah, yeah. Every week we had a new mentor who was a major star. I'll give you names. I'll name drop for you. We worked with Kenny Rogers 1 week. We worked with Rod Stewart.
Wow.
They flew us to Vegas 1 week, 1 weekend to work with Barry Manilow. Wow. And at the time he was like really knee deep in his show there. So he couldn't come to LA to work with us. So he brought us there. Well, you know, the show brought us there. So that was a really fun and wild trip.
I actually sang for Rod Stewart's wedding when I was a kid. I've sung with Barry Manilow twice. I've done backup vocals for him a couple times. And both are just sick. Iconic. They're just like so ridiculous. So just for you to have
that. So sweet.
And you know what? For you to have that opportunity is amazing because you're like meeting icons in every realm of music. You know what I mean? Like, was there someone in particular that you were just like, man, I can't believe this. This is the pinch me. But I can't believe this is happening. Who was that mentor for you?
Well, there was a couple. Stevie was our mentor 1 week. And it was really sweet because everyone at that time, it was like we were in the top like 10 or maybe top 9 or 8. So it was kind of getting down to the end part and the latter part of the season. And it was really sweet because everyone knew what a huge fan of his I was. I mean, who isn't really, right?
Right.
But they knew how much I loved to sing his music. And so they somehow, all the big mouths that were on our season, they somehow kept the secret from me because they all knew. And they kept it a secret from me until Stevie Wonder actually walked in the studio.
Wow.
And I'll just never forget it. Like, I looked at him and I knew exactly who it was right away. And it didn't even look like, just me being such a fan, it didn't even look like he was walking. Because it looked like he was like gliding across the room. Yeah. And I just burst into tears, you know, like a little schoolgirl, just because I was so surprised and just so stoked to meet one of my idols. And the cool thing was, is that, you know, every mentor that we work with, they shoot B-roll of us working with them individually. And then they shoot other B-roll of them sort of on their own commenting on their time with us, you know? And so, you know, Stevie said, one of the things he said about me was he said, you know, he should definitely pursue this as a career, which was the whole point of me being there.
What a blessing to hear from him too, man.
I mean, if I hear nothing else, if I do nothing else, So that was super cool. I also had a really great time working with we had a Queen week on the show. And at the time I wasn't that familiar with Queen's catalog or how extensive it was. And at the time, Paul Rogers from Bad Company, you'll appreciate this, was touring with Queen. And so we went out to the pond in Arrowhead to work with them and shoot all of our B-roll with them. And I was sitting there with Paul Rogers like all day long, just picking his brain and talking to him. And I remember the one thing he did not really want to talk about was Bad Company or how that ended with him and them, which I didn't really understand at the time, but now I get it. But I was asking about them because I love Bad Company. Right. So, but that was a lot of fun talking to him. And I mean, we work with so many people. I mean, gosh, the list just goes on. Every week it was a new, you know, A-list, you know, performer and artist. So we had the best of the best. And each, you know, each session I took something different and learned a lot about, you know, their careers and what they do. They were all so forthcoming and just really gracious to be in our company and to be helping us. So that was really cool too. You know, no one was too cool for us. Everyone was really into it. So
pretty huge. You made it all the way to the final three. That is a huge accomplishment and a testament to your character and your musicianship. Tell me what that experience was like. You're in the final three and you're about to go on stage. What did you sing? And like, how did you feel? Like, what did you think what was going to happen?
Well, I mean, at that time, top three, I thought, well, I actually have a real shot at winning this thing, which I had no, that wasn't really a part of.
right.
You know? But so I'll tell you, the first word I use is just exhausted. It was such a whirlwind experience, especially getting down to the end there. I mean, they were, you know, we had hometown visits, top three. So, and then the week before that, the top four, it was me, Chris Daughtry, Taylor Hicks, and Catherine McPhee. And they flew us, we had Elvis week that week. So they flew us to Graceland to shoot B-roll with Tommy Mottola and and the late Lisa Marie Presley. And both of those trips to our respective hometowns and to Graceland were done in like 20 hours. So it was exhausting, but it was just such a blast and just so exhilarating, you know.
Right.
But it was very fast paced and I don't really know, looking back on it, a lot of it's so blurry, but looking back on it, I don't know how any of us did it. I mean, how we memorize, you know, 90 seconds of lyrics for a song.
Right.
The arrangements of them. And as the weeks progressed and as we got down to the, you know, towards the end, we'd have more on our plate. Like we would do like two or three songs each show. But during the week we were always rehearsing. We were going into the studio and doing background vocals, our own background vocals for the group songs that we would do.
Right.
And then we were doing a lot of stuff on camera, just shooting a lot of B-roll. And so it's just nonstop, go. And I'll tell you, you know, when I got the boot, I was exhausted. I had messed up a few lyrics that night, and I just had a feeling that it's probably the end of the line, and I was completely okay with it. I don't want to use the word relief.
Well, because you're probably mentally fried at that point. It's like, almost borderline not fun because you're going with the machine and getting plugged into every which way and just kind of like also jumping through all the hoops, and the hoops are also like on fire. You know what I mean? So
it's on fire, yeah.
You know, so you're doing all the kind of like, you know, the circus of Hollywood, you know, antics, and also trying to like tap into music, and then there's a competition, and then you're on TV. You know, it's just like, man, I can't imagine the emotional upheaval that you probably went through just going through all of that. So in some ways, even though you didn't make it to the final two, it must have been a little bit of a relief on some level too. You know what I mean? Like on one level, your dream is probably going to pivot and change, but you got huge amounts of showcasing, you know, TV time. But at the same time, you wanted this to happen. And now, even though it didn't happen for that one, you know, that one show, man, you got to the final three, and then there's also like a relief of, oh my God, this is overwhelming to be just, you know, in the circus. So
yeah,
tell me what those emotions were like, because it's a really complex thing that a lot of people don't understand, having gone through that level of competition, you know?
It's hard to describe because it's all of it is just so unnatural. It's not, right. you know, yeah. it's not any, not a part of our daily lives. So right. I think I speak for all of us who went through that process, how exhausting it was. But, you know, I was soaking it up like a sponge and really taking what I was learning and applying it to my everyday life on the show. And also storing it for when, because I was, again, you know, my main goal was to make moves and make moves with the exposure and take advantage of this amazing platform that they gave us all to, right. To start a career doing what I love. And, so I was storing all that. I was off, you know, off show, off campus. I was sort of assembling my, trying to find a manager and.
Yeah. And I mean, you did get signed, right? Like that. That was one of the things that did come out of it for you, which is amazing. That's like what you hope for, is that someone signs you to a record deal, right? And tell me what happened after the show.
Well, so after the show, they took the top 10 of us on a nationwide arena tour where we played sold out arenas for 60 nights.
Wow.
And that was incredible. And we lived on a bus for, you know, like 2.5 months. And that was just an incredible experience. And then we were all under contract through the end of that tour. And then they didn't pick up my option, which was also a big relief to me, because I had an idea of what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it, even though I didn't really know what I was doing on the business side of things. I had some help, which was great, outside of Idol. So they didn't sign me to their management deal or their record deal. And they gave me their blessings to do whatever I wanted to do, as long as I didn't release anything before the people that they did sign, which was Catherine McPhee, who finished second, Taylor Hicks, the winner, and Chris Daughtry, who finished fourth. They had signed the three of them to their own deals, you know, and so they were focused on getting their stuff out as soon as they could. And they just told me, do what you want, just don't do it before they do it. So that was great. And so I got to sort of take my time a little bit and figure out how to navigate the business end of things. And I started writing music. And so on the business side, I ended up writing a few songs that Sony ATV Publishing heard. And so, you know, long story short, they offered me a publishing deal, which I ended up parlaying into a record deal. Kind of, we did a really unique thing at the time. This was 2006, 2007, where Sony ATV made me a partner with them to wow. put out my album. So we did like a 50-50 sort of deal, which didn't exist at the time and will probably never exist again. But timing is everything, and that was just the right time, and I was very lucky to have you know, a lot of good people in my corner to help steer me through that process. And so yeah, wrote some songs. They signed me to a pub deal, which I used to make my album, my first album, and put it out. And you know, again, got lucky with my first single, Wait For You, that came out in 2007.
That's one of the videos that you sent, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's play that real quick. We're going to play Wait For You by Elliot Yammin.
I never felt nothing in the world like this before. Now I'm missing you and I'm wishing you would come back through my door. Let me know. So now I'm all alone. Girl, you could have stayed, but you wouldn't give me a chance. With you not around, it's a little bit more than I can stand. Ooh. And all my tears, they keep running down my face. Why did you turn away? So why you forget about me.
You gotta be feeling crazy. Ooh, how can you walk away? Everything stays the same. I just can't do it, baby. What will it take to make you come back? Girl, I told you what it is, and it just ain't like that.
Slamming, dude. Great vocals.
Thanks,
really slamming, dude.
Thank you.
So tell me, like, what that experience was like. You're doing your first music video, you're doing your first record, you're just off the show. Did you find like it was like creative freedom? Did you find like you were still attached to the machine and people were telling you how to create on some level? Tell me what that was like for you. Nope. Did we just lose you, Elliot? You there? You froze. Oh, I see you now. I see you. All right. Did you get that question? Did you hear that?
You know what? I'm going to go back to my OG location. Do you hear me?
Yeah. No problem. No problem.
Service is a bit spotty.
No worries, dude.
I don't know why.
We'll travel with you, dude. We're going to go on a little magic carpet ride over here, dude.
bear with me, guys. Bear with me.
No problem.
My apologies. Let me get back into the.
You look like you're being chased.
Scary movie. Look like a scary movie vibe, right? All right, let's plug this in. Okay.
No problem.
Sorry, guys.
Okay. All good. So I don't know if you caught my question. Did you hear any of the question?
I heard enough of it.
I was just saying. Like with you doing this video and you getting a record contract, you're in the studio making your first record. Did you still feel like it was a creative freedom, or did you have some attachment to the machine and there was input on the kind of music you were making? Tell me what that was like.
No, I had complete creative freedom, which was awesome. And, you know, there were a lot of songs that I got submitted because there were a lot of songwriters that, you know, that were popping at the time. And being a Sony ATV songwriter officially now, I had access to just copious amounts of like the best of the best songwriters and songs. Dude, I still listen to a lot of demo songs that were submitted to me that were just so dope and are still incredible that I just play in my, you know, that I put in my playlist, and sometimes they'll come on my shuffle in the car. And I even often check sometimes if the song's ever made, some of which made it to other artists and became big. But so So I actually have the demo versions of some hits that are out there, which is kind of cool. but yeah, there was a lot of that. And Wait For You was one of those songs that was submitted to me. And at the time was, you know, Stargate was like, Stargate, the producers of that track were, you know, they were like sliced bread. They had like, I think at the time, man, they had like four of the top 10 songs at top 40 on the radio, you know? And I'll be honest, when I first heard the song, my manager was like, you got to go record this. You got to go to New York, meet these guys, record the song. Just trust me, you know? And they, you know, they had way more foresight than I did at the time, especially when it came to choosing songs. But so let's rewind for a second. I got this song. I got to songwrite a lot. I got to co-write. I had a lot of co-writes. I wrote a lot of songs, a lot of which didn't make the album, but a lot of, you know, a lot of which did. But Wait For You was not one of them. That was a song that was submitted by Stargate and my dear friend, Taz Jackson. We're friends now. And we've been friends since we, you know, met in the studio and recorded that song that he wrote, which changed both of our lives for the better. So,
met those guys have a show on LA Talk Radio, the Jackson Brothers.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. Yeah. They actually have a show about, you know, their mom was murdered. I don't know if you knew that, but their mom was murdered, or she died like in a really kind of crazy way. So they're on there as like, they have a show on LA Talk Radio talking about grief counseling, kind of like overcoming this huge upheaval that can, you know, be a trauma, you know what I mean? So pretty great. So I met him actually at the station. Yeah. When we had the station before the pandemic. But anyways.
You have to send me the link to that. I'd love to check that out.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
That.
Yeah.
That's cool. Wow. Yeah, man. Taz, he's an amazing cat and so talented. And I flew to New York. I just went there for the sole purpose of cutting Wait For You. And then I hit it off so well with Stargate that, you know, we were vibing so well that I ended up recording five other songs. So I ended up like in a 2-day period, I cut six songs with those guys in their studio.
Wow.
in New York. And we ended up using four of those songs, two or three on the first album, and then a couple or two or three on the second album, my second album. I love working with those guys. And here's a funny story about that whole that process is that the first day I was in there, the first day I met them, you know, we cut Wait For You, and then they were like, why don't you stay for a little bit? We've got some other songs we want to play you and see if you want to cut. So they did that, and I was like, sure, I'll do that. I'll cut. Why? Where else am I going to go? Let's do it. You know, let's get as much work done as we can. And I'm hungry, you know, so I'm like, let's do it. And these guys are the it producers, you know, the hit makers. So then all of a sudden, like, I think I went to the bathroom or something, and I came back, and they're like kind of rummaging through stuff, and they're like cleaning up and organizing in like this really like hasty way. Like they're like, that they have somewhere to be or something. And I was like, what's going on? And they were like, oh, Beyonce's here. And so we're gonna ask you to come back tomorrow because we've got something to do with Beyonce and she's here. And so I was like, all right, cool. And so this is 2007. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then I didn't expect to run into her, but I went into the break room like to grab a snack for my walk back to the hotel, you know? So I was going to fill up my backpack with some snacks, and there she is. She's just sitting there with like a whole table full of Chinese food that she brought in for everybody. And I was just like, whoa. She goes, and she was really sweet. She's like, hi. I said, hi, I'm Elliot. Hi. And she offered me Chinese food. She asked me if I was hungry.
What?
She asked me if I was hungry, Nikki. And you know what I said?
You said no.
No thanks.
Oh my God.
I'd have been like, I'm good.
I'd have been like, what did you order first? And then I'll decide. Why did you say no? That's crazy.
Dude, I'm like, what are you? It was like a Costanza moment. I'm like,
yeah.
Like, what are you doing? You said no to Beyonce?
That's
who are you?
Yeah, right.
And but it was a long day. I was tired. I was probably just wasn't even, I don't know what, I don't know what was going through my mind, but I actually said no thanks, to be honest. When awesome. I could have sat down and had some Chinese food with her in the studio.
But, let's play. I want to play another song. What do you want to play next?
Oh, well, I think I sent you a version of David Bowie's Heroes that we did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I love that song. Let's do that.
Yeah. Okay.
Best Heroes, David Bowie's cover by Elliot Yemin.
Forever and ever. just for one day.
That was fire, bro.
Thanks, man.
And to correct myself, it's Elliot Yamin. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no worries, man.
Good. No, no.
All good.
I know how it is. My name is Nikhil Karula. That has been stumbled upon many a time. So, dude, I appreciate you telling me. Where can people find you if they want to find you online? We're running out of time. But, dude, I'm going to have you back because, dude, first of all, you're an amazing interview. And second of all, man, you got music coming out your pores, bro. Like, we got to collaborate. We got to make some music. And I definitely want you back. I want to showcase more of your music. But where can people find you online if they want to check you out?
Well, I don't have my own website anymore. But I do a lot of posting on my Facebook page and my Instagram. And also, I've been playing a lot with our mutual friend Lau Tizer. So
yeah, that's right.
Been gigging a lot with him this year. So all of my dates that I'm playing out and about can be found on his website, lautizer.com, as well. And let me just plug you for a second, because if anyone out there has yet to hear or see Nikki live, do yourself a favor.
You
want to get inspired. Go see what this cat does and has in his bag, man.
Well, I'll tell you, like, I saw you in the audience and I was like, I don't know if that's who I think it is, but you and Lau were there. And I was just like, this is going to be a cool, cool gig. And we've got to collaborate. We've got to write some tunes together. We definitely have to put that in the books. And you've been a great guy to just get to know. But, man, I got to tell you, I've heard a lot of people cover that song. I have not heard a lot of people cover that song like that. That was tremendous. It was.
Thanks, man. Thank you. Yeah.
How did you do that? So you got to, I'll tell you something. You got to always sing that song. You got to make that song a staple because you sing the shit out of that song. So,
thanks, man. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, man. You slay. So, you know, check what's your Instagram in case people want to add you on Instagram?
It's Sing Like You Mean It. All one word. Or just type my name in, you know, you can find me there. And then I'm just Elliot Yamin on Facebook, on my Facebook page. And thanks to Lau. I've been posting a lot on Facebook lately because we've got so many shows and stuff. So
yeah, man.
I haven't really been using that tool that often until really this past year and a half. So
well, yeah, let the people know. Thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood, man. You're a great cat. And we'll have to make some collaborations happen. I want to come see you perform again. And thank you for the kind words about my own music, man. I appreciate that. But yeah, man.
Yeah, of course, man.
Thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. We're gonna have you back, Elliot. We're gonna have you back, man. Check out
We'd
Elliot.
Love to do it.
Check out Elliot on all the YouTube, Spotify, anywhere you can find him. Check out his music. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Elliot, we'll see you guys next week. Peace and love.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Karula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.